ability to offer empathy to people in stressful situations can defuse potential violence. A teacher in the inner city of St. Louis related an incident where she had conscientiously stayed after school to help a student, even though teachers were warned to leave the building for their own safety after classes were dismissed. A stranger entered her classroom, where the following exchange took place. The man said, "Take off your clothes." The teacher, noticing that he was shaking, "Sir, I'm sensing this is very scary for you." Man, "Did you hear me? Damn it, take off your clothes." Teacher, "Sir, I'm sensing you're really angry right now, and you have a need to be obeyed." Man, "You're damn right, and you're going to get hurt if you don't." Teacher, "I'd like you to tell me if there's some other way of meeting your needs that wouldn't hurt me." Man, "I said take off your clothes." Teacher, I hear how much you want this. "Did you hear me?" Teacher, "At the same time, I want you to know how scared I am and how horrible I feel and how grateful I'd be if you'd leave without hurting me." The man, having received the understanding from her, hearing her vulnerability, said, "Give me your purse." The teacher handed the stranger her purse, relieved not to be raped. He then ran out the room. She later described how each time she empathized with the man, she could sense his becoming less adamant in his intention to follow through with the rape. A Metropolitan Police officer attending a follow-up training in nonviolent communication once greeted me with this account. "I'm sure glad you had us practicing empathy with angry people that last time. Just a few days after our session, I went to arrest someone in a public housing project. When I brought him out, my car was surrounded by about 60 people screaming things at me like, 'Let him go, he didn't do anything. You police are a bunch of racist pigs.' Although I was skeptical that empathy of the kind you taught us would help, I didn't have many other options. So I reflected back the feelings that were coming at me. I said things like, 'So you don't trust my reasons for arresting this man? You think this has something to do with race?' After several minutes of my trying hard to reflect back what I understood they were feeling and needing, the group became less hostile. In the end, they opened a path so I could get to the car. Finally, I'd like to illustrate how a young woman used empathy to bypass violence during her night shift at a drug detoxification center in Toronto. The young woman recounted this story during a second workshop she attended. She told me that at 11 p.m. one night, a few weeks after her first training, a man who'd obviously been taking drugs walked in off the street and demanded a room. The young woman started to explain to him that all the rooms had been filled for the night. She was about to hand the man the address of another detox center when he hurled her to the ground. She told me, "The next thing I knew, he was sitting across my chest, holding a knife to my throat and shouting, 'You bitch, don't lie to me. You do too have a room.'" She told me how she then proceeded to apply the training she had received the first session by listening for his feelings and needs. I said, "You remembered to do that under those conditions?" I was really impressed. She said, "What choice did I have? Desperation sometimes makes good communicators of us all. You know, Marshall," she added, "that joke you told me in the workshop really helped me. In fact, I think it saved my life." I said, "What joke?" And she answered, "Remember when you said never to put your butt in the face of an angry person? Well, I was all ready to start arguing with him. I was about to say, 'But I don't have a room,' when I remembered your joke. It really stayed with me, because only the week before, I was arguing with my mother, and she said, 'I could kill you when you answer but to everything I say.' Well, imagine if my mother was angry enough to kill me for using that word. What would this man have done? If I'd said, 'But I don't have a room,' when he was screaming at me, I have no doubt he would have probably gotten more angry, and who knows what he would have done. So instead of saying, 'But I don't have a room,' I took a deep breath and said, 'Oh, it sounds like you're really angry, and you want to be given a room?" He yelled back, "I may be an addict, but by God, I deserve respect. I'm tired of nobody giving me respect. My parents don't give me respect. I'm going to get respect." So I just focused on his feelings and needs and said, "So, sir, if I'm understanding you, you're fed up when your need for respect isn't getting met." And I continued to hear his feelings and needs when whatever he said. I asked her, "Well, how long did this go on?" She said, "Oh, about another 35 minutes. He was in a lot of pain." I said to her, "That must have been terrifying." She said, "No, you know, Marshall, surprisingly, not after the first couple of interchanges. Yeah, I was really scared for the first couple, but I saw that whenever I concentrated on listening to his feelings and needs, I stopped seeing him as a monster. And I could see, just as you had said in the workshop, how people who seem like monsters are simply human beings whose language and behavior sometimes keep us from seeing their humanness. The more I was able to focus my attention on his feelings and needs, the more I saw him as a person full of despair whose needs weren't getting met. I got more and more confident that if I held my attention there, I wouldn't be hurt. After he received the empathy he needed, he got off me. He put the knife away, and I helped him find a room at another center." Delighted that she'd learned to respond empathically in such an extreme situation, I asked curiously, "Well, what are you doing back here? It sounds like you've mastered nonviolent communication. You ought to be out teaching others what you've learned." She responded, "Oh, now I need you to help me with a harder situation, Marshall," she said. I said, "I'm almost afraid to ask. What could be harder than that?" She replied, "Now I need you to help me do this with my mother. Despite all the insight I got into that but phenomenon, you know what happened? At supper the next evening, when I told my mother what had happened with the man, she said, 'You're going to cause your father and me to have a heart attack if you keep that job. You simply have to find different work.' So guess what I said to her again, Marshall? 'But, Mother, it's my life.'" I couldn't have asked for a more clear example of how difficult it can be to respond empathically to one's own family members sometimes. Because of our tendency to read rejection into someone's no or their message, "I don't want to," these are important messages for us to be able to empathize with. If we take them personally and interpret it as a rejection, we may feel hurt without understanding what's actually going on within the other person. When we focus our attention on the feelings and needs behind someone else's no, we become aware of what is going on in them, what's alive in them that prevents them from responding as we would like. And instead of getting a rejection, we really then see that we're getting a gift. We're hearing an opportunity to contribute to this person's well-being. For example, one time during a workshop, we were going to take a break and go walk down to the corner and get some ice cream. I invited one of the participants to go with us. "No," she replied brusquely. The tone of her voice led me to interpret her answer initially as a rejection, until I reminded myself to tune into the feelings and needs she was expressing through her no expressed with such vehemence. I focused on her feelings and said, I sense that you're angry. Is that so?" "No," she replied. "It's just that I don't want to be corrected every time I open my mouth." Then I could see that she was fearful rather than angry. I checked this out by saying, "So, are you feeling fearful and need to protect yourself from being in a situation where you might be judged for how you communicate?" "Yes," she affirmed. "I can imagine sitting in the ice cream shop with you and having you notice everything I say and telling me how it's not nonviolent communication." I then discovered that the way I'd been providing feedback in the workshop had been frightening to her. My empathy for her message had taken the sting out of her no for me. I heard her desire to avoid receiving the kind of feedback I had been offering the group. Assuring her that I wouldn't evaluate her communication in public, I then conferred with her on ways to give feedback that would leave her feeling safe. And yes, she then felt comfortable to join the group for our ice cream trip.